Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So this week we had not a lot going on, but we had a few interesting things that happened this week. One of the first things we did was Ben, our oldest son, we got him a new bike.
Yes.
It was time.
He had obviously outgrown his old one. Like, his knees were
bumping into the handlebars. Yes.
But he was, you know, he'd been like trying to ride it, and then the tire went flat and wouldn't reinflate. And
that's a nice passive way of putting the tire went flat. I'm wondering how the tire went flat. They ride their bikes pretty hard on things.
They do.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened with the tire. Anyway, we could have spent the time and, you know, money to patch it up. It was not unfixable, but why bother fixing a bike that
is too small. And so is probably too small even for Anthony.
Right.
Honestly.
I mean, we could save it for Lucy, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing was, like, having to get a new tire for it. I got to find a place to get a tire, go there, buy it, put it on the bike. And it's on the back. So it's with the gear shifter and all that. And you have to deal with that. And it's like, oh, and, you know, for what? So that he can have a bike that he barely can ride because he's too big for it. So long story short, after I kept promising him that I would take care of the bike for a couple of weeks. I mean, I feel bad. I just didn't have time to go hunt down a tire. I said, all right, dude, get your mask, get in the car, we're going to Target. And we went over to Target and I bought him a new bike.
Probably he was very happy.
He was very happy. It's probably more than I wanted to spend, honestly. Probably not as much as some people could spend. I mean, as far as like Target bikes go, it wasn't super expensive, but it, you know, it's a bit expensive for us. He's been riding it. He's getting outside. He's getting some exercise, and that's good.
Yeah, and the weather's been pretty good.
Yes, apart from
the weird snow.
We had snow this week. Yes, the April, what was the date? April 15th, tax day, although not this year. Tax day, it was the 16th. We had snow in Massachusetts. That just doesn't happen for us. I mean, it's occasionally happened, I recall. I was saying today, the latest in my life I ever remember snow falling in Massachusetts was, I think it was like either May 6th or May 13th.
Well, my Facebook memories say that actually it had snowed before on that day in 2014.
Yes.
So
followed by the winter from hell. So hopefully that wasn't a precursor. Oh, yeah. It wasn't much snow. It melted like within a day. We got quite a lot of rain, though, in the last few days, which we needed. We definitely needed that. And today, though, was beautiful.
Sunny.
Yeah, well, sunny at times.
Partly cloudy.
Partly sunny, partly cloudy. We got out. We went to this new place that I found online called Burridge Pond Wildlife Area, which is in a town near us, about 30 minutes away, about a half hour
from
us.
Something like that.
And it was a Cub Scout den outing. And I've been waiting for the weather to get better. Because we can't have our den meetings indoors because of reasons, you know, the usual. And we've been trying to do some outdoor stuff, but the weather's just been so bad. So finally the weather has turned enough that we can get out and go places. And so I organized a hike today. Unfortunately, only two other boys came. It's school vacation week in Massachusetts. We get two spring vacation weeks, one in February and one in April, because April 19th is Patriots Day, and so there's a week off or something. Nobody else gets it anywhere else, apparently. But anyway, we went. So I organized this hike at the Burridge Pond, and it was a nice hike. It was a
really lovely hike.
It's apparently a new area. Like they've newly opened it. It's owned by the state. And it used to be, I was looking it up. So originally it was the Great Cedar Swamp, which I love that name. Back in the 1700s and 1800s, it was the Great Cedar Swamp. It got logged out. Like they pretty well logged out all the cedar. Back at the turn of the 20th century, it was used to Albert Burridge, hence the name, began digging peat moss to use as fuel. And then he founded a dye company, Dye Stuff. So he was one of the largest dye manufacturers in the United States during World War One. It was in huge demand for uniforms. Yeah, who knew?
Okay.
Then eventually it was shut down. They sold it to a cranberry concern who converted the wetlands into cranberry bogs, which was a big no-no back in the 80s, and the EPA shut them down. And in 2002, actually, the state bought the land. And so it still gets some cranberry bogs. There's a big open pond. There's some red maple swamps, some Atlantic white cedar that's growing there, apparently, they said, and some freshwater marshes and streams and things like that. So there's
lots and lots of wetlands.
Lots of wetlands. It's 2,000 acres, which is huge. And the Audubon, by the way, has 600 acres adjacent to it. So it's a big, open, you know, wildlife area. And we saw plenty of birds.
We saw egrets, herons, swans, ducks, geese, red-winged blackbirds, song sparrows, swallows.
Yeah, you said the swans, the egrets, the herons. Yeah, the ducks. Yeah, tons of birds, which was a lot of birds for this time of year. It's kind of unusual, to see that many birds at this point. Like, maybe in a month, we'll be even seeing more birds. But it was nice. It was a nice three-mile hike. It was flat, so no up and down, no hills. Big, wide, paths to walk on.
Yeah, big enough for, like there were lots of people out on bikes.
There was bikes, some people on horses, so...
One woman walking some llamas.
There was even llamas in the field. That was wild. That was kind of a little unusual.
Like two llamas on leashes.
Yeah, llamas on leashes. And and then people fishing there. And I think we're going to have our fishing derby there, our Cub Scout pack.
One guy fishing in a boat on the pond.
Yeah, kayaking. It was really nice. And there's a huge, like I said, it's a huge area. So I'm kind of looking forward to maybe going back and exploring some more of it. So this was one of a group of trails in this one town in Hanson, Mass, that are all new. I got this link to this website. Where was it? And it had I was the Googling for places to go hiking. Nature Walks in Hanson, 9 worthwhile places to explore. So there's 8 more to go. To check out. I mean, that was a good find. So I was kind of happy about that. It took us 3 miles. Took us about almost 2 hours.
Yeah,
we kind of went at a relaxed pace.
And we stopped and we looked at things. And the kids climbed around on some
ruined buildings, some old ruins.
Yeah, and
it was good.
Looked at birds.
Yeah, that was a good walk. So the other thing. Another new thing this week was I finally got a new fire pit. I've been meaning to do that. Our old one that I bought like 10 years ago, it was cheap and it had rusted out and it finally had collapsed. The one leg, I was like holding it up with a log. It had finally collapsed. It'd been left out in the rain and, the weather, and it just was, it was going to rust out and all that stuff. And so it eventually did. So I got a nice new one. It's better. And I got a cover for it. So, to cover it up. And so we had a fire that first, the first night that I had it, I promised them I would do a fire. Although we didn't get to do the s'mores.
No.
We ran out of time for that. But I have to say, getting them to go get wood from there's a place in our neighborhood that's, they call it the in-between place. It's in between two roads. And people drag their old, all their stuff, their yard refuse there. So leaves and stuff, but even trees and other things. So they go and they collect wood from there that we use to have fires. And so they go pretty readily now these days. If I can promise them a fire, they'll go and get the wood. So I like that. That was good. We had the good time today, especially. So let's talk about food. We have not been doing a lot of.
We haven't been doing much.
This is, I think this is our pattern. We have a holiday where we have a lot of cooking. And then in the week or two following, we like,
we did all the cooking. Yes. We don't want to do any more cooking.
My cooking brain has been drained, and I will give me a few weeks to recharge that because I have my cooking creativity.
Much. Yeah.
I did make one new thing this week. I'd seen this recipe for sweet and tangy grilled country style pork ribs, Cook's Illustrated. And I've been seeing the country style pork ribs at the supermarket. And it was kind of curious. So, you know, there's the baby back ribs, which I've been smoking. But these are grilled ribs, which means they take, instead of hours and hours, they're supposed to take like, a half hour or so to cook at most. And I was like, that could be an interesting alternative. So I picked some up and I don't know. What do you think? They're not as good as the smoked ribs. That's I think that's clear.
I mean, I'm not a huge, ribs person anyway, so
yeah,
I'm probably not the best judge.
Right,
they were not bad.
There was the country style ribs have little bones in them.
There was that was disconcerting. There were little bits of bone on the bottom part of it.
I think that's more about the butchering than it is supermarket butchering. It's hit or miss.
I do not like finding chips of bone in what I'm eating. It kind of turns me off.
Yeah, it's disconcerting. Makes it lose your appetite a little bit. I think the grill was kind of crowded, and so it didn't cook as well as I wanted to. If I'd had more time for it to really get some good sear on all sides, I had crowded the grill because I got extra ribs for the whole family. I thought we might need extras. And because I was making eggplant on the grill at the same time, and it just wasn't enough room. So that was my mistake. I'll try it again and maybe try some different things. And I think it needed more rub as well. It didn't have as much flavor as it could have.
Although Isabella said it was too spicy.
Well, I could dial back the spice, but, the heat, but you still have some flavor to it. This brown sugar, cayenne pepper, chili powder, salt. I could put some other things in it, try something different and try to up the flavor there. I might try it again at some point, not right away, but we'll see how that goes. I might do a pork shoulder. That might be interesting. A little harder to do because on a Weber, but we'll see. So that was the cooking. Yeah, it was all right. We'll try it again. So let's talk about now what we've been reading or watching. I watched a couple things this week. I watched Godzilla vs. Kong on HBO Max. Uh-huh. I still had HBO Max because I'd watched Snyder Cut Justice League for Secrets of Movies and TV. I will buy a month at a time to watch a particular thing if I need to, $15. And then I try to watch as much as I can to get my money's worth and then cancel it. But so Godzilla vs. Kong, it's kind of Transformers with big animals.
Yeah, not my genre. At all.
It might have been my genre when I was younger, but it's not really my... I was kind of bored with it. And also annoyed with the implausibilities. I mean, it's already giant ape and giant lizard. Okay, I could live with that. But things like... They would really, let them rampage through a city, destroying things, willy-nilly. There were characters in this movie that had nothing to do, major actors. Why is this guy even in this movie? He's not doing anything. It was just kind of because he was in the last movie. It was just kind of poorly written, poorly thought out.
I thought that was pretty much the entire genre is things destroying cities and not much plot.
But they could have plot. In destroying a city, it's one thing to destroy the city, but when it feels like a cost, you know what I mean? This is they've destroyed a city. Ha ha. It's no big deal. There's no consideration to the thousands of people who are dying and all those buildings that are being knocked down by the giant lizard running into it and that sort of stuff. If you're going to have a disaster movie, you have to have this feel of the disaster. Otherwise it just seems gratuitous. I don't know. I felt like that was it Man of Steel? The final. I don't know if you saw
it. Never saw it.
Yeah. There was a final battle in Man of Steel and it just felt like, It was like disaster porn. I hate to bring in the word, but It was just like, let's see what else. Let's see how many iconic things we can destroy. It was almost like a Roland Emmerich film, like in that sense, which maybe it was. Was it Roland Emmerich? Maybe it wasn't. But the funny thing about, like, when I say it's like it's a Transformer movie, spoilers, it has Mecha Godzilla in it at some point. Like, this whole silly plot line about Mecha Godzilla being, like, at first it's remote control telepathically, but then it gets independent and the AI in it takes over. It was just, anyway. If you're a completist, if you love Godzilla, if you love King Kong, like, the other Godzilla movies were better. I felt like they were pretty good. This one, not a fan. Anyway, the other thing I watched on Netflix was a new docudrama called This is a Robbery, about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1989, I think it was, and I kind of forget now. But around that time, it was the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is a small museum in Boston with an amazing collection, all collected by Isabella Stewart Gardner, who around the turn of the 20th century was a huge patron of the arts and gathered all the stuff together and said, this is my collection, given in perpetuity to the people.
She built the collection. She also built the museum,
the building itself.
Which is in the style of an Italian palazzo, to house her collection. And in her will, she is basically said, like, the pieces are where the pieces are. You can't move them.
She said, if you move the art, there was a stipulation, something about if you move the art beyond X, okay, it must be packaged, shipped to Paris, sold at auction, and the proceeds given to Harvard. So you know that, like, somebody from Harvard goes there, like, probably once a year to make sure all the art's where it's supposed to be.
I mean, she really, really, really wanted it to be exactly where it is.
She was
eccentric.
She was very eccentric. This is the perfect placement of all the art. And it's an amazing place if you ever get a chance to go there.
It's gorgeous. It really is. But I had a roommate when I was in grad school who was doing a museum curating certificate, like, program, and basically they, like, part of her program was they had to curate a museum exhibit, and so we actually had an interesting conversation about the Gardner. Like, it is a curator's nightmare, because, like, you can't do anything.
Yes,
you can't curate exhibits. They actually built a new modern wing where they can curate, like, one exhibit or two a year.
Yes. And which was hugely controversial because there was debate over whether it violated the spirit of Isabella Gardner's her will. And so it's interesting. The other interesting thing about it is, if your name is Isabella, not Isabel, not Isabel with an E or Isabel with one L. If your name is Isabella, just like Mrs. Gardner, you have free admission for life.
Yes. So our oldest daughter,
Isabella, gets in free for life. Not our intent when we named her. No. Also, there's an annual Isabella party on Isabella Gardner's birthday. Anyway, so that's Isabella Gardner. And it has some amazing artwork. And, you know, the Rape of Lucretia, Botticelli's the story of Lucretia. The Rape of Europa was the one. They have Titian's. They have John Singer Sargent. Like, amazing. Fra Angelico. So, in 1990, St. Patrick's Day, 1990, there was a break-in. Two thieves broke in, disguised as police officers, and robbed the museum of 13 pieces of art worth a total of $500 million at the time, which makes it the greatest property theft in history. $500 million, $500 million worth of art. The single most valuable piece was Johannes Vermeer's The Concert, which was valued at over $200 million. They also stole Rembrandt's The Storm on the Sea of Galilee, which it breaks my heart because they cut the art out of the frame. Like, they butchered it, really. And this stuff has been gone for the past 30 years. It's never been recovered. And this huge... I listened to this podcast a couple 2 years ago from the local PBS radio station, that kind of went through the heist and all of the theories and who might have done it and who was involved. And this is kind of following a lot in the same direction, the same things, but taking advantage of the visual medium. But it's necessarily shorter. I mean, the podcast, it was like hours and hours and hours. This has only got four episodes, so it's like 4 or 5 hours of documentary. But it's really, I've followed ever since because I was a paperboy. No, was I still a paperboy? I remember this happening and being fascinated by it at the time and then following it a little bit here and there as it came up in the news over the years. And the thing that kind of gets me is that they think one of the theories is that it's the mob was behind it, the local Boston mob. And there are reasons why that interests me. Personal familial reasons why that interests me, that maybe somebody I know might have a connection to somebody who might have a connection to somebody involved in that. That's nothing. I'm not revealing anything too close. I don't actually know anybody definitively, but you know, my dad might know some guy who might know a guy who might know somebody who was involved. You know what I mean? That sort of, my dad's Sicilian from Boston and I know that he knew guys involved in this sort of world. So I'm
not the specific
case. My dad knew mafia guys, knew mob guys. One of his best friends was a mob guy. It's interesting to me that he might know somebody who was involved, but yeah, it's kind of fascinating. So it hits you. If you love art, it hits you on that level. If you're fascinated by mysteries, it hits you on that level. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a Boston thing, so it hits me on that level. So the documentary itself, This Is a Robbery, is pretty good. They don't go, it's not too over the top in the sensationalizing there's no commercial, so you don't have to come back from commercial and have them recap the rest of the episode.
I hate that episode design, that narrative style.
Yes, I hate that. But it's pretty good, and they do a pretty good job of framing it, no pun intended, including some of the weird aspects, like some of the weird things that were stolen, like a finial from a Napoleonic flag. The finial, like they had to unscrew the bolts holding it onto the top of a flagpole. Like, why? There was a ancient Chinese beaker, like 1,000 years old, that was all by itself in another room that was bolted to a table. They had to unbolt. Why?
Like, so somebody really wanted that particular beaker?
Maybe. Yeah, it's a very, like, but it's not even all that valuable. That's the thing. Like, I mean, it's art, it's history. I mean, it's valuable in and of itself. But, you know, compared to all of the other things in the museum, it's not, these two things aren't really that valuable. And then, like, they took some paintings off the wall as if they were going to steal them, but they never did. There was a small Rembrandt etching self-portrait. It was like, it's like a postage stamp. It's like about like an index card size in a gilt frame. It's small enough you could shove it in your jacket. Okay. They took the time to take it out of the frame. They cut other things out of frames, but this one they could have just shoved in. The theft itself doesn't make sense. The things that were done. So it's very interesting. It doesn't feel like a professional art theft, because part of the reason they say they don't think they were like professional art thieves is because the stuff is so famous that you can't sell it. Like, an art thief wants to steal something that he can sell, that, you know, it's worth something, but it's not so famous that no one could ever show it anywhere.
Right. Like, you can't steal the Mona Lisa because you can't
do anything with it. You can't sell it.
You could have it in your private collection and have the Mona Lisa on your wall.
Yeah, there's like some Arab sheikh sitting in his, you know, in Brunei or in, you know, the United Arab Emirates. And there's a private vault room, and then there's hanging the Storm on the Sea, and no one else could ever see it. Or some Greek shipping magnate, you know, the old stereotypes of the wealthy guys. I guess it's now probably some Russian oligarch, you know, and he goes into his private vault and there hangs the Storm on the Sea. And only he can look at it, and he sits down and drinks a brandy while staring at it. Like, really? like it's like a Bond villain thing, you know? It just,
I love that you have these plots in your head, like these whole scenarios of who
well, you think about it, who could put, there has to be someone with an incredible amount of money who wants things for the solely for the sake of owning it.
Or else they're sitting in a warehouse somewhere because the thieves realized after they took them that they couldn't actually get rid of them.
Or worse, they think they may have buried them.
Buried them?
Yeah. Like they're sitting moldering somewhere in a crawl space or in the ground because they couldn't move them. They couldn't do anything with them.
What a waste.
Or burn them. Like that's a horror. That makes me horrified to think about.
Like at that point, just, you know, put them in a neutral place and then
just walk away. Call somebody.
Call somebody and say, hey, the art is, you know, over.
Or there's a $6 million reward for it. Like, or I think it's now $10 million in 2017, as of 2017. Hey, I got a tip that these paintings are over here. What do you know? Hey, I'll take the 10. You know what I mean? Like, at least it's, and that's what that's why they offer the 10, because they want the thief to come forward. If, you know, say just take it, you know, at this point, you know, it's just, it's devastating. Think about it. There's like the Vermeer that they're talking about. He only painted so many paintings. Vermeer only has very few actual paintings. The concert is one of 34 known paintings by Vermeer.
Really? Only 34?
Yes. There might be a 35th one, but there are 34 that are considered definitive.
I knew that he had a very small number of paintings. Like,
yes.
There are people who make a life project of going and seeing all the known Vermeers.
Right. I mean, this is a beautiful painting. It is, like, if you get a chance, go look it up on Wikipedia. You know, and there's this woman about to sing, you know, and she's just in the act of about to start singing, you know, you can see it there. And then you have the paintings in the background. I mean, it's very typically Vermeer, right? And it's just like, it's gone. It's gone. It's just so devastating. So anyway, it's a really interesting. I've only watched the first episode of the Netflix documentary. And so I'm kind of looking forward to watching more of it. I haven't had a chance to.
Okay.
So that's what I've been watching. What have you watched? In the Marvel Universe.
which Marvel Universe movies has Melanie watched this week?
Yes.
I think last week I had.
You'd started.
I'd started Civil War. I finished it this week, which was good. And then I watched Doctor Strange. And then I started Black Panther, and then, like...
Because you've seen Black Panther before.
I've seen it before.
But it's worth rewatching.
I decided to rewatch it, because, you know, he appears in Civil War. So I thought, oh, you know, now I've seen more of it, like, it might be more interesting, and I still think I was falling asleep during, but so I need to...
Yeah. What did you think of Doctor Strange?
I like Doctor Strange. It was fun.
I mean, it is...
It's Benedict Cumberbatch. I like Benedict Cumberbatch a lot. I know some people...
How's his American accent? It's very nasally.
Yeah, it's
he's not great at accents. He's okay.
It's okay. It doesn't bother. I'm not sitting there going, oh my gosh, his accent is so bad. I'm not really paying attention to
it. His Boston accent in The Departed was horrible. It was so awful. But yeah.
I mean, some people don't like him. I like him.
Oh, I like Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah.
I like the trope of the
Man of science,
medical professional, great, you know, he's very arrogant neurosurgeon. But I like the man of science who then finds himself as sort of an inadvertent magician. Like it's a fun trope. And I thought he did it well. Like I really enjoyed him sort of going, I do not believe in any of this stuff. And yet here he is, like a very powerful sorcerer.
Yes. The cape. The cape is great. It's really funny.
And of course, it has a lot of really fun CGI effects, like the twisting and turning, like as if the city becomes like the innards of a giant machine almost. Like it's a very interesting visual language that they developed for this movie.
It's right out of Inception, actually. I mean, it feels like it's inspired by Inception, that idea of the unfolding of the world.
I didn't feel like like Inception quite had the same sort of clockwork gear turning feeling.
No.
Which I really like. That's specifically, this almost feels like the buildings become these like giant gears. Like they're turning and meshing into each other. And it really, like, I really liked the way it felt. It really sort of twists space in an interesting way that my mind wants to see more of it. I want to slow it down and say, how are they doing that? That's really interesting. I liked Doctor Strange. It was fun. Black Panther, also kind of fun.
So I didn't like Michael B. Jordan in the first time I watched it. He's the bad guy. He's Killjoy or whatever his name is. The villain named Kill something. Killmonger, I think it was. Killmonger is the bad guy in Black Panther.
Killmonger? I don't remember that.
You don't remember Killmonger? Come on, I'm going to Google it.
I don't remember his name being Killmonger.
Eric Killmonger.
I don't remember that name.
In the MCU. So, I'm trying to think of where I can find a picture of him.
I thought they were calling him, like, Claw or something.
No, that was, wasn't that the other guy?
Are you remembering, like, a different...
No, I'm looking it up now. Because everyone listening is going, yeah. Njidaka, Eric Killmonger Stevens. Yes, it's right here. Black Panther, Njidaka, Eric Killmonger Stevens.
I don't remember him being called Killmonger.
Okay. Well, in any case.
Okay. Sure.
I didn't like his character in the first time I watched it. I didn't like his acting. I thought it was really meh. But you know what? It turns out, like, I watched it again. I'm like, no, it's better. I don't know why I didn't like him the first time. The second time I liked it a lot better. So
that's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. I liked Black Panther, and I'm really. I mean, I'm sad for the loss of Chadwick Boseman. I mean, yeah. It's sad that we lose someone so young anyway. But I'm also sad because he was so good as
Black Panther. He was so
Panther.
Really good.
And, like, what are you going to do? Like, what are they, like, you can either recast the role.
Yeah.
Or you can make someone else, quote unquote, the Black Panther, like, which happens in comic books. But
right. I mean, you could have him have died and then put, you know, some relative on the throne, I suppose.
But, right.
Or just have another actor playing.
Have another actor be him. Yeah.
For pretending that we don't notice the difference.
Ooh, we could have Michael B. Jordan take over the role. That wouldn't be confusing at all.
Okay. You know, I actually, one of my college friends knew Chadwick Boseman. She actually acted with him in New York.
Uh-huh.
They were in a theater company when they were both very young and getting started. She actually got stuck in traffic in, like, driving the property van home one day. So it's kind of fun.
With him?
With him. They had one of those sort of, like, long earth-changing conversations you have when you're young where you just, like, kind of talk about, like, what you want to do with your life.
Uh-huh.
She shared this really funny. beautiful meditation when he died, sort of this, like...
I mean, they stayed friends over the years, yeah.
They stayed friends. They stayed in contact. Well, she kind of, I think at one point, like, at the point where he was, like, cast as Black Panther, she started to sort of go... Will he remember me? Should I, like, contact him, or is he going to think that it's weird that I'm, like,
that you, now that he's famous,
I want to
be his friend. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
It's tricky when somebody, you know, gets, like, sort of makes it big.
Right.
But yeah, great Black Panther.
Yeah. Good movie.
So yeah, moving right along.
So, all right.
I'm reading, I haven't finished anything, but I started Rosemary Sutcliffe's Frontier Wolf, which is a historical novel in her Roman Britain series.
Mm-hmm.
It loosely follows one family, and you can kind of tell that the people are members of this family because they all have this ring that's passed down from generation to generation, which is an interesting idea, like this sort of following, like, hundreds of years apart, some of the characters, But
in one novel or over the series?
Over the series of novels. So it's a very loosely connected series. Like, it's not following one character or even like father to son to grandson to great grandson. It's like skips generations in between. You're not exactly sure how they're connected. But the Aquila family, they're basically a family of soldiers who end up settling in the first one is Eagle of the Ninth, and he ends up settling in Britain. And then you kind of follow his descendants as this one is at the time of the Byzantine Empire. So Rome has become Christian. It's after Constantine. And so Britain is kind of like really crumbling and falling apart. And the main character is sent to a fort on the frontier of Scotland.
Right.
And he's in disgrace because he made a really bad error, a really boneheaded error when he was in command in Germany. And so he's been sort of like given the post that nobody wants. To command these like sort of. It's a the scouting unit that are like sort of half wild. They're mostly wild tribesmen. They're the wolves, and they don't really follow Roman discipline terribly well. And it feels a lot like Sutcliffe's other novels. Like, there isn't a whole lot so far that's standing out, but it's kind of a familiar universe, and I really like her stories a lot.
Good. Yeah. Awesome. So I finished a series, another Star Wars trilogy, and this called Alphabet Squadron. Might have mentioned it before. So this is more a grittier series. So the author is Alexander Freed, and he has written several Star Wars novels that kind of take the gritty look at things, like the war and the cost of war and the cost of war on soldiers. And it covers the time period after the Battle of Endor. So in the year following the destruction of the second Death Star. You know, even though Lucas in his special edition showed celebrations of victory of defeat of the Empire, obviously in reality it would take time to mop up. And in fact, that's in the extended novels and things like that. They have depicted the mopping up in the final.
Right. You don't just like win a battle and then woohoo, the war's over. Right. We're all done.
All the moffs and grand moffs and grand admirals don't just step down and walk away. So in the movies in Force Awakens, we are told that like the last battle of the war is at the Battle of Jakku and where Rey is. And so this series of novels takes place in between. And it starts with a character and the idea of what do you do with defecting Imperials who defect after the Battle of Endor? Like before the Battle of Endor, they're joining the rebellion. And so you can kind of feel like there's a principle there. They're doing it because of a principle, because, you know, to be a rebel is to be the Empire is against you. But once the Empire is on the decline and the New Republic is on the rise.
You start to worry about some self-interest happening.
Yes. Why are they defecting? Are they defecting just because or surrendering just because they see which way the wind is blowing, or because they have real conviction? Or, and so there are these camps where they take in the Imperials and they interview them and they hold them there and they try to figure out, you know, who's worthwhile. And then there's this one pilot, TIE fighter pilot, who is there, who's recruited by New Republic intelligence, and they form a special alphabet squadron. It's alphabet because they have all the different kinds of fighters in it: A-wings, Y-wings, X-wings, and a U-wing. And a B-wing. So it's the whole alphabet. And they're brought together to hunt down this one particular TIE fighter unit that is the elite of the elite that she used to be part of. And there's a whole undercurrent story, a secret that she's hiding from the New Republic, that she, you know, atrocities that she might have participated in, and then some various other stories. And it's very interesting to see the interplay some of the characters are cynical. Some of the characters have pure motives. Some of them are just angry at Imperials. And so it's a very interesting thing. And eventually in the second and third novel, Hera from Star Wars Rebels shows up, and she's General Hera Syndulla. And by the third novel, she has a very key role in the whole story. And it's very interesting to watch how that develops. So it's good. Not the best Star Wars novels I've read. After a while, I kind of got like, okay, let's get this done. We're dragging it out a little bit. Did it need to be three books? Could have been maybe two. But nevertheless, I enjoyed it. I like that grittier look. It's more like almost more realistic look at the cost of war, you know, the post-traumatic stress that the soldiers endure, and the questions of, like, one of the questions that come up is, after you've defeated the Empire, there are millions of Imperials, former Imperial soldiers, bureaucrats, whatever, out there, all who have participated in some kind of atrocity of one kind or another, some kind of human rights or sentient rights violations, not just humans,
right?
Some sort of war crime of one kind or another. And what do you do about that? Do you spend decades prosecuting them all, hunting them down?
So do you have like a Nuremberg trial sort of scenario?
Right. Or do you have a truth and reconciliation scenario where...
like Rwanda?
Right. Where you kind of deal with it and move on. You know, you bring about reconciliation. And so that's actually a key question that is brought up.
Interesting.
Without necessarily resolution in the books. But the questions get asked and they get struggled with. So that makes it, that's interesting as well. So it was there's some pretty good aspects to the book. So I got to say that I did enjoy that. So
makes me think of Isabella's paper topic. Do we talk about that?
Which one? Oh, I don't think we did.
Yeah. So Isabella had to write an essay for her writing part of her English class. And she chose to write about just war theory and the Clone Wars, which I thought was really interesting. So she first had to research what is just war theory. And she had an idea of what it was, but she didn't really know the specifics. So she did a lot of reading about just war theory. And then she wrote about like the specifics in the Clone War and tried to apply the theory to the story.
Interesting. Well, and then you got a very big difficulty, a very big obstacle or hurdle there in that discussion, because the war was manipulated on both sides by one man. He created the war.
Right.
So in that, fundamentally, it's not a just war.
Right. It couldn't possibly have truly been just.
Right. If Darth Sidious Palpatine was behind it. Right.
And the essay that she was writing was not actually a argumentative, like a persuasive essay. It was what they called an exploratory essay in the book that we're using. And so it's where she sort of lays out the questions and the research, but she doesn't actually argue, like try to make a point.
Right.
She just kind of looks at both sides.
Interesting.
So I thought this was a really good topic to do that with, because she didn't necessarily have to make up her mind about whether it's just or not and build an argument. She just sort of had to explore what are the things that one would look at in order to determine whether it's just or not.
Hmm. That's good.
She could have developed it a little bit more, but you know, considering this was her first essay that she's written, I kind of let it be there. We might work over the summer on revising it, but we're just trying to move on to the next assignment.
Yeah, you want it to have been a fun, interesting assignment and not turn it into a slog.
Right. Yeah.
Good. That's cool. Yeah. So as far as whether I would have the kids read it, I might let Bella and Sophie read it, but I don't think Anthony would be, I don't think I would have him read it.
No.
It's really unfortunate. In some of the Star Wars novels, they're introducing some elements that I just don't, from our point of view, they're immoral. I mean, and which means, I think from an objective point of view, there's same-sex relationships of not really strongly, like you could read it and not pick it up. But I saw it and like, yeah, that's what they're hinting at there. So in other Star Wars novels, they've been more blatant about it. And that's annoying because I don't feel like I can pass those on to the kids. So that's too bad. Yeah. Anyway, so that's Alphabet Squadron. So pretty good. So the one thing I wanted to bring up was the changing things going on with masks. Now, obviously, every place is doing masks under these COVID conditions differently.
Some people are not really doing some people, anything.
Right. For some people, there's nothing different in some places. For us, where there's diocesan regulations that limit attendance at mass and way things can be done, how communion can be distributed, what, you know, the congregational singing, that sort of thing. But aspects of it are left up to the parish, what how seats are allocated. Our parish has a ticket system that's changing.
Right. And the max occupancy was actually defined by the state guidelines.
Right.
Which the archdiocese adopted rather than
rather than push back. Right. I mean, at least we got to be in church.
It was up to the pastor to decide what to do. Like, this is your maximum occupancy.
How do I fill it? How do I decide who gets to sit where?
Right. That was.
Right. Some parishes are doing like a sign up genius, which is a website where like you sign up every week for a slot at a mass. Our parish has done like a sort of semi-permanent, like you sign up. This is your pew at mass every week. Boom. This is your pew at this mass, which means you don't get a lot of flexibility. If you need to do something different next week, there's, you know, you're out of luck.
But at the same time, there was only one English mass.
There's only one English mass at our parish being offered. So it is what it is. So, and then they increased the capacity. So they allowed more people to come in. So they moved some things around. But this coming week, they're changing it to a first come, first choice system where
rather than signing up, show up and
you show up as long as they have your name and phone number.
He was not clear as to what they were like. Were we going to?
I hope they're not going to take name and phone number to everybody as they come in the door.
Like, can I just write it on a card and hand it to the usher as we walk in so we don't have to?
Or just say you've already got my information, because that's going to slow. Like, if they have to write everything down for every person coming in as you come in, that's going to slow things way down.
Yeah.
Mass will never start. But the idea is they want to be able to allow people to just come to Mass, like including people who are just interested, who have never been to Mass before and are just interested in going. I mean, that's got to be that has totally stopped the past year. We do not have people coming, just showing up anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So I applaud that. That's good. And frankly, I wouldn't mind going back to sit in our regular pew if we can, at Mass, like miss sitting in our pew.
I wonder if we'll see some people who haven't been coming.
Right.
Start showing up.
There's plenty of folks that I remember from before who I haven't seen since. You know, they're not live streaming anymore. Have you noticed that?
I did notice that. In fact, they which that makes me a little sad because.
Yeah. Not everybody's vaccinated. Not everybody can get out. Yeah, I mean, I guess I can imagine it's a huge burden to live stream the three camera setup every week.
But maybe even like one camera.
Yeah, I don't know. And then, you know, they got to do the microphones, they got to do the lighting. So it's all that extra work. I mean, that guy has to be there. And then I wonder if they've been paying him, which would be an additional expense.
Right.
You know, so I get it. And I think they're still doing the Cape Verdean Mass. I think they're still streaming that.
Right.
Because they have a much higher demand. They're still packed to the gills. I think we're not getting full capacity at our parish, like at our mass,
Right. Oh, no. There was lots of empty, even with every other row seated, there were lots of empty rows.
Right. So I think Father's trying to encourage people to come to mass instead of staying at home. I don't know. But like you said, there are people who just can't come because they can't get the vaccine or they just not comfortable. Anyway, there are other streamed masses. So they're changing that this week. One of the regulations that they talked about, like they've been talking at mass, is we weren't allowed to sing at all during mass. We were allowed to say the prayers, but there was no congregational singing at all. And then recently they changed it to allow singing of the mass parts, not the hymns, but the mass parts, except for the responsorial psalm. And I was kind of taken aback. Like, we can sing the Gloria, we can sing the Sanctus, but we can't sing the responsorial psalm. What makes the responsorial psalm different? It's not as long. I mean, the Gloria and the Sanctus are longer.
It it felt kind of like a weird arbitrary guideline.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is there's no explanation of how these decisions are made. Like, somebody's making decisions. And I'm just curious, like, what's the criteria that we're using? How do we determine this? What is the principle that we're operating from? I kind of wish there was a little more transparency on that, just because it feels arbitrary. And you're sitting there going, what's going on? Like, what is going on? And even one of the things I was saying to you before we started recording was, how is this all going to end? Like, it just, at this point, it feels like we're getting vaccinated. Things are loosening up a bit. But are we ever going to be able to go back to going to mass without masks, walking up the aisle to receive Holy Communion on the tongue, like normal, and have the sign of peace again and all that sort of thing? Like, it doesn't feel like we're even close to that. I mean, are we going to gradually move in that direction, or is there going to be a day where we snap our fingers and say, now we're back to normal?
It doesn't feel like there hasn't been any communication as to which of those scenarios is going to happen. Like, there's no
right
plan, or if there is a plan, we haven't been told what it is.
Right. It's a little frustrating. I mean, there's people I could ask, you know, what, you know, is there a plan? Do we, you know, what do we look like? What is the timeline? Do we even have a ballpark timeline? Is it late? Are we looking at later this summer? It's like, there's an internal guideline. I don't think even the priests know. I don't think even the priests have been told. I think there's a handful of people in the pastoral center who have an idea.
And are they just reacting to what the state guidelines
whatever
are?
Whatever the governor says?
Because I'm pretty sure the governor isn't, like, issuing guidelines about singing in churches and stuff. So where is that change coming from?
Right. Is that a guideline coming out of the USCCB, or is that they're just, like, yeah, who came up with that? Like, and it's, and I don't want this to come across as a rant or a anti, you know, conspiracy theory, they're putting us down sort of thing. I'm confused and wondering, like, it just, and I can't be the only one. You know, there must be other people out there who are wondering, how are these decisions made? Why are we making the decisions we're making? You know, what's coming? What are we doing? And it's just, I think it's the uncertainty. We've lived in a year of uncertainty.
It's been a lot of uncertainty and for a long time.
I think it's just getting to me. And I want more certainty about certain things, like the mass, like, or at least I don't even necessarily want certainty, because there's no certainty in life, I guess. But what I'd like to have is more clarity. More, you know, of a idea of that there's a vision and a plan and a where we're going. I mean, the state at least talks about, okay, we hope to have kids being vaccinated by the end of the summer. Okay, that's something I can look forward to.
Although the state has also been unclear about, like, what is that going to mean for opening businesses or mask mandate or any like that. Like, at what point are they going to lift the mask mandate?
Right.
Is there a number that we're shooting for when we hit X percentage of people vaccinated
right,
or X percent of people, like, testing positive, or what is the goal or guideline that we're shooting for before we change things?
Well, and I think reporters have asked the governor this, and he just sort of says, we're just following, we don't have any different plans. We're just keeping, we're staying fluid. We're, you know, whatever. We're just trying to get people vaccinated at this point. But you know that somewhere on a whiteboard on Beacon Hill, there's a number.
Someone has to have talked about this.
Right. They have to have. Okay. What are we looking at? Well, let's see what happens when we get to 70%. Let's see if we get to 75%. Like, I want to know does it change anything if I know the number? I guess not, but not for me. But I want to know that someone's got a plan. And I want to have an idea of this, that, you know, we estimate we will hit the number sometime in June.
Right. That would be nice to know.
Like, yes.
It would be nice to know that this is finite and not sort of indefinite. I think that's what it is.
Right.
A sense that there will be an end, maybe at some point, a light at the end of the tunnel.
I mean, we're making plans for a summer vacation, and technically, there is no one said that we'll be able to go and to another state or whatever and do the thing we were planning to do. Like, we're just making plans, assuming that we'll be able to do it.
Well, there's no regulation saying we can't.
Well, no, there's still the, like, as far as I know, there's still the quarantine thing. Like, if we go to Maine, there's still a 10-day or 14-day quarantine in
like
effect.
The state of Maine has a quarantine.
Right, rule. For people coming from out of state, from Massachusetts. Now, that may not be true for people who've been vaccinated. I haven't seen the regulations yet on that, whether that's changed. But you know what I mean? It's just there's a lack of clarity on where we're going. And I mean, I can imagine if I owned a club, you know, or other music venue, what it would be like to not have any sense of when I could reopen and have people come in and have my business continue. Yeah, that's anyway. That's where we are. There's no resolution there. I'm sorry. I wish I had answers, but I just have questions.
Lots of questions.
Questions. All right, let's wrap things up. We want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Daniel E., Kevin N., Adam C., Kenneth L., and Gary J. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What'd you think of our discussion? You can let us know by, if you have any insight that I have shared that I didn't have, please share it. You can do so by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And we'll have links from our discussion in our show notes on sqpn.com. If you can, we really appreciate it. It helps us a lot when you write a review at Apple Podcasts and when you share the podcast with your friends to help us grow our community and reach more listeners. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.